I want to start with something that happened maybe 6 years into my time doing hospital work. A family was in the ICU waiting room. Mother had come in after a cardiac event, and the adult son was just sitting there, not crying, not talking, just completely shut down. My instinct was to sit with him, let the silence do its work, but I'd recently read some material on anticipatory grief in acute care settings, and something in that shifted how I read the room. I didn't treat him differently. I didn't quote anything at him, but I held the space differently. I wasn't waiting for him to break open. I understood that what I was seeing had a shape to it. That context changed how I showed up.
And I think that's exactly the tension I want to name right at the start, because it's real and it doesn't go away. Chaplaincy trains us in presence. We sit with people in the hardest moments of their lives, and the work is fundamentally relational. It's not diagnostic. It's not clinical. So when we start talking about evidence and research, there's a legitimate question. Are we drifting? Are we trying to become something we're not? Why does this conversation belong to us at all?
It belongs to us because the people we serve deserve a chaplain who has done their homework. That's the short answer. The longer answer is that the field has changed. We're sitting at tables with physicians, with incident commanders, with mental health teams. And if we can't speak to what we know and what the research actually supports, we get sidelined, not because we're less valuable, but because we haven't made the case.
Right. And the risk runs both ways. Ignore the evidence and you're operating on habit and instinct alone, which can go wrong quietly in ways you never notice. But overclaim the evidence, dress up presence as clinical intervention, and you've overstepped your role in ways that can actually harm people. That's the tightrope this episode is about. So let's walk it.
So let's actually get into it. When I look at what the research on spiritual care outcomes tells us, honestly, the picture is more complicated than either the enthusiasts or the skeptics want to admit. There's a body of work showing that chaplain presence in hospital settings correlates with things like patient satisfaction, reduced anxiety in people facing serious illness, and more peaceful end-of-life experiences. That's real. But I want to be precise about what correlates with means, because it's not the same as causes.
That distinction matters enormously, and it's where I see a lot of well-meaning chaplains get themselves into trouble when they're making the case to administrators or clinical teams. They pick up a finding, strip out the nuance, and suddenly a correlation becomes a proof. The methodological challenges in this field are significant. How do you standardize what a chaplain does well enough to study it? How do you measure something like spiritual support in a way that translates to a research instrument?
And the literature acknowledges them. The more rigorous work in this space is pretty upfront about small sample sizes, the difficulty of controlling variables, the fact that most studies happen in specific institutional contexts, large academic medical centers, for example, that don't reflect where a lot of chaplains actually work. So when I read something that shaped my practice, I'm always asking, does this translate to my context? A finding from a well-resourced urban hospital doesn't automatically speak to a rural emergency department or a fire station.
Let's name the gap that I think is most significant for our listeners, the first responder literature. If you're a public safety chaplain, law enforcement, fire, EMS, the evidence base for your specific work is thin. There are frameworks being developed. There's growing attention to occupational trauma and cumulative stress in those populations. But we don't have the same depth of study that hospital chaplaincy has accumulated over decades. How do you hold that honestly?
You hold it by being honest about what you're working with. When I'm talking to an incident commander about why a chaplain should be embedded in a department's wellness program, I'm not going to manufacture evidence I don't have. What I can say is, here's what we know about the documented spiritual and existential needs of people who work in high trauma occupations. Here's what the research on peer support and social connection tells us about recovery from occupational stress. And here's where we're extrapolating from adjacent fields. That extrapolation is worth naming, not hiding.
I appreciate that framing, adjacent fields, because some of the most useful material for chaplains isn't labeled chaplaincy research at all. Literature on trauma-informed care, on complicated grief, on the spiritual dimensions of serious illness, that work often lives in nursing journals, in psychology, in palliative care. The evidence is dispersed. That's actually part of why reading a research brief and knowing how to extract what's useful is a skill we need to be building.
Which brings me to something I tell newer chaplains I supervise. When you encounter a finding that seems to directly support what you already do, slow down. That's exactly the moment to look harder at the study design, the population, the limitations section. Confirmation bias is real. The research that has actually shaped how I show up is sometimes the research that complicated my assumptions, not the research that validated them.
So, the answer to how do you cite evidence with confidence without overclaiming isn't a formula, it's a posture. You speak to what the research suggests, you name what it doesn't resolve, and you stay in your lane. That's not weakness. That's exactly the kind of intellectual honesty that builds credibility with clinical partners and commanders who can smell overreach from a mile away.
Let me put you in a room. Mass casualty event, industrial accident, multiple fatalities. I arrive while the scene is still active. There's a man outside the perimeter, not a worker. Turns out he's the father of one of the victims. He doesn't know yet. He just knows his kid isn't answering the phone. And everything I've read about traumatic notification, about anticipatory grief, about the window before a death is confirmed, none of it was in my hands in that moment. It was somewhere behind my eyes. The question isn't whether I use the research. The question is whether I've internalized it enough that I can put it down and be present.
That's where I want to push, because I think that's the idealized version of it. You say, put it down and be present. But what does that actually feel like from the inside? Because I've supervised chaplains who thought they were putting the framework down, and what they were actually doing was running a quiet clinical assessment the whole time. They were present in body and categorizing in the back of their mind. And that split shows. People feel it.
You're right that it shows. And I've been that chaplain. Early on, I had enough exposure to grief literature that I was tracking stages, tracking responses, almost running a checklist. And a woman in an ICU waiting room once said to me, not unkindly, "You look like you're waiting for me to do something." That landed hard. She was right. I was waiting for her to perform grief in a way that matched what I'd read. That's not presence.
So does leaning on evidence create distance? That's the honest question I want to hold here, because I don't think the answer is simply yes or no. I think the answer is, it depends on whether the evidence has become a lens or a script. A lens expands what you can see. A script tells you what's supposed to happen next. And the moment you're running a script, you've stopped being a chaplain and started being something else.
The place where I've seen this most clearly is with first responders, particularly firefighters who won't talk. And there's actually some useful framing in the trauma-informed literature about why that silence isn't resistance. It's often regulation. The nervous system is doing what it needs to do. But if I walk in with that framework front and center, I'm going to sit down next to a guy at 2 a.m. after a bad call and immediately start interpreting his silence. That's a problem. What the research gives me is patience. It tells me the silence has a function. It doesn't tell me what to do with it.
And that patience is actually a clinical adjacent skill, which brings up the refer not treat question directly. Because you're sitting with a firefighter who won't talk, and at some point you start noticing things, not just silence, but something in the quality of it. Withdrawal that feels different. Statements that edge toward hopelessness. You're not a clinician. You're not there to diagnose, but you're also not blind. How do you hold what you're noticing without turning it into a diagnosis?
This is where I think the refer not treat instinct has to be active, not passive. Passive is waiting until something obvious happens. Active is paying enough attention to what's in front of you that you can say, quietly, without clinical language, "I'm concerned about you, and I want to make sure you're connected to someone who can really support you through this. I'm not naming what I'm seeing as a disorder. I'm not treating. I'm making a connection." That's the handoff. And the key is you don't make the handoff and leave. You stay long enough for it not to feel like abandonment.
That fear of abandonment around referral is real. And I want to name it because it shows up in supervision constantly. Chaplains resist making the referral because they're afraid the person will feel handed off, discarded. But that fear, when it's not examined, can actually become harmful. You stay past your competency because leaving feels like rejection. And the person in front of you ends up in the care of someone who isn't equipped for what they're carrying, which is you, when what they actually needed was a pathway to someone who is.
The referral done well is still pastoral care. The way I've learned to frame it is, I'm not stepping back from you. I'm making sure you have more support, not less. That framing comes from paying attention to how people receive handoffs, which is something I've learned partly from observation and partly from reading about how care transitions work in trauma contexts. So even the mechanics of making a good referral are informed by evidence.
I want to shift to something the outline raises that I think is genuinely under-discussed, the religious framework problem. A lot of the research on spiritual care outcomes was conducted in contexts that assume some kind of religious or theistic orientation. The measures used, the outcomes tracked, they often have spiritual and religious functioning so entangled that it's hard to extract what applies to someone who is secular, atheist, or simply outside the traditions the studies were designed around. What happens when you walk into an ICU room with a research frame built on one set of assumptions and the person in front of you doesn't share them?
This has come up for me in real encounters more times than I can count. I had a man, no religious background, described himself as a lifelong atheist whose wife was dying, and he was angry. Not at God, not at anyone specific, just furious at the situation. And every framework I had that was built on meaning-making through narrative or spiritual resources or connection to tradition was useless to him in that moment. What he needed was someone who wouldn't flinch at the anger and wouldn't try to redirect it towards something transcendent. The research that helped me most wasn't chaplaincy literature. It was work on existential distress in non-religious populations, which is a growing edge in palliative care.
Which is a reminder that multi-faith neutrality isn't just about being respectful of different traditions. It's about not assuming that the category of spiritual means the same thing to everyone in the room. For some people, spiritual care sounds like religious care, and they don't want it. If you walk in with a framework that treats spiritual and religious as interchangeable, you've already lost the relationship. The evidence base has to be interrogated the same way the encounter does. What assumptions are built in, and do they apply here?
And honestly, that interrogation is something you do before the encounter. Not in real time. In real time, you're reading the person in front of you, adjusting, following. But the work of knowing which research frameworks carry religious assumptions and which don't, that's preparation work. That's what makes it possible to walk into a room and not be surprised when the framework doesn't fit. You expected it might not. You're ready to work without it.
So, the through line of this whole section is that evidence doesn't replace attunement. It prepares you for it. It gives you a wider peripheral vision before you enter the room. But the moment you're in the room, the person in front of you is the text. Research is commentary. And when the commentary stops serving the text, you put it down.
So let's get practical, because I think that's where this conversation has been heading. When a research brief lands in front of you, whether it came from your department, a clinical partner, or you found it yourself, the first question isn't what does this prove, it's what does this prepare me for? I read for patterns of need, not for protocols. What are the documented experiences of people in this population? What tends to go unaddressed? What does isolation look like in this context? That's the extraction work. Not, here is a finding I can deploy. Here is a finding that widens what I'm able to notice.
And that distinction, widening what you notice versus arming yourself with conclusions, is actually the reflective frame I use in supervision when I'm trying to figure out whether a chaplain is applying evidence or hiding behind it. The question I ask is the research helping you stay curious, or is it helping you feel certain? Because certainty in pastoral care is almost always a warning sign. If you're walking into a room feeling certain about what you're going to find, the framework has become a wall between you and the person. Curiosity keeps you open.
That test has teeth. And I'd add a companion to it from the field. After a significant encounter, I asked myself whether I was reading the person or reading the category. Because sometimes what looks like evidence-informed practice is actually just categorization. You've put the person into a box that research helped you build, and you're relating to the box. That's when you know the evidence has stopped serving you and started substituting for you.
The other side of this is the institutional conversation, talking to clinical partners, commanders, administrators. And that's where I see chaplains either undersell themselves completely or overclaim in ways that backfire. There's a middle path. When you're making the case for chaplain presence or for a specific intervention, you speak to what the evidence suggests, you name the limitations honestly, and you connect it directly to an organizational need they already recognize. You're not selling research. You're translating it into their language.
Two things I've learned to do in those conversations. First, I never lead with chaplaincy literature. I lead with the population's documented needs. If I'm talking to an incident commander about embedding a chaplain in a peer support program, I'm starting with what we know about occupational stress and cumulative trauma in first responders, not with studies about chaplains specifically. Get the need established first. Second, I use hedged language deliberately, not to sound weak, but to sound credible. The research suggests, findings point to, what we're seeing in adjacent fields. That precision signals that I know the difference between a correlation and a cause. Clinicians and commanders trust that more than certainty.
And the third thing I'd add, which is more about posture than technique, know when to stop citing and start listening. Because sometimes you walk into an administrative meeting prepared to make an evidence-based case, and the real conversation is about budget or turf or a bad experience someone had with a chaplain 2 years ago. The research won't fix that. Presence and relationship will. The evidence gets you in the room. What you do in the room is still pastoral.
Which brings it back to refer, not treat. Because I think some chaplains experience that guardrail as a ceiling, like it's the thing that keeps them from being taken seriously. I want to name it as the opposite. Knowing your lane is not a limitation, it's professional integrity. When I'm clear about what I do and what I don't do, clinical partners trust me more, not less. The moment I start drifting into clinical assessment or therapeutic framing, I've introduced ambiguity about my role, and that ambiguity costs me the relationship I need to do the actual work.
Exactly. And there's something almost countercultural about it in environments where expanding your scope feels like advancement. The chaplain who says, "That's outside what I do, and here's who can help," is modeling a kind of professional confidence that's actually rare. It communicates, "I know what I'm for, I take it seriously, I'm not trying to be everything to you, I'm trying to be exactly what you need right now." That's not a smaller role, that's a sharper one.
We've covered a lot of ground, so let me ask you directly. If a working chaplain walks away from this conversation with one thing, what do you want it to be?
Stop waiting until you're in the room to do your formation. That's what I want them to hear. Read. Engage the evidence. Sit with the uncomfortable findings, the ones that complicate your assumptions, not just the ones that validate your practice. Because the person who shows up at 2 a.m. deserves a chaplain who has already wrestled with the hard questions. Not one who is meeting them for the first time in the middle of someone else's crisis. The preparation is part of the pastoral care.
And here's what I'll leave you with. Something I've learned the hard way, more than once. The research will not hold you accountable. The firefighter who doesn't call back won't hold you accountable. The family you sat with once and never saw again won't hold you accountable. You are the only one in a position to ask whether what you did in that room actually serve the person in front of you. Not whether it felt right, not whether it matched a framework, whether it served them. That question has to be habitual. Ask it after every significant encounter. It will keep you honest in a way nothing else will.